This is the morning service at Holy Trinity on the 24th of February 2002. The preacher is Paul Barker. His sermon is entitled Good Citizens and is based on Romans chapter 13 verses 1 to 7.
And you may like to have open in front of you Romans chapter 13, page 923 in the Pew Bibles. 1980s, one of the presidents of South Africa was P.W. Botha during the time of apartheid in that country. Like much of the South African leadership, he claimed Christian allegiance. In October of 1985, there was a movement called the National Initiative of Reconciliation. It was an attempt by Christians, I gather, to try and bring about an end of apartheid and reconciliation between all the different racial groups within South Africa. And on this day in October 1985, one of its leaders, a significant Christian minister, had an appointment with the president, Mr. Botha. And he went to this appointment with some hopes of at least the first steps of the dismantling of apartheid. On reception, the president, Mr. Botha, read these words to him: "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God." And so he continued by reading these words from Romans chapter 13, words that have been controversial in some sense throughout history since they were written by St. Paul nearly 2,000 years ago. In a world where there is so much corrupt government, not only in our day but in Paul's day as well, these words are surprisingly positive about government and surprisingly strong in their statement that Christians ought to submit to government, in effect, full stop, without qualification. When we consider that just a few years, 6 or 7 years before St. Paul wrote these words, Christians were expelled from Rome, along with Jews, these are surprisingly positive words about government. When we consider St. Paul's own unjust treatment at the hands of local authorities throughout his time, as we read in the Acts of the Apostles, these words are surprisingly positive about government. And when we consider that Jesus, of course, was cruelly and unjustly put to death by Roman authorities, these words are surprisingly positive about government. How can he be so positive? Well, see what he says. The end of verse 1, Paul says that all governing authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Hitler? Pol Pot? Beginning of verse 3, he says, "For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad." Idi Amin? Beginning of verse 4, "For it is God government, governing authorities, are God's servants for your good." Is that really true for Christians who lived in communist Soviet Union? How can Paul be so positive? Can Christians really submit to such evil regimes and states? The basic reason, Paul says, we are to submit to government is because it's instituted by God. It's ordained by God. Its authority comes from God, he says in verse 1. And he doesn't qualify it there by saying it's a Christian government. After all, he's writing to Christians in Roman Empire, which was very much a pagan state. Indeed, opposed to Christianity here and there, and that opposition would grow within the lifetime of Nero, who had just become emperor at the time of this letter being written. Paul is saying that all governing authorities, whether they're in name Christian, or whether they're Muslim, whether they're atheist, whether they're anti-Christian or not, communist or capitalist, they derive their authority from God, they're instituted by God. His words here echo Jesus' words at his trial before Pontius Pilate. you remember Jesus saying to Pilate at trial, "You would have no power over me unless it had been given you from above." And there is Jesus saying what Paul says here, in effect, that the authority of any governing authority derives from God, even if it's evil, as Pilate was, as much of the Roman Empire was. Even the authority that a government has when it acts in badness and evil things ultimately derives from God. At the last book of the Bible, there are a series of visions about the end times, in effect, and the Roman government and state is parodied as a demonic beast, a satanic beast. But even there, where the authorities are regarded as hostile to Christians, in the extreme, the power that that beast has was given to it, the text says in Revelation 13, by God, that is. So even there we see that evil regimes derive their authority ultimately from God. So that's the first point, in effect. God is the ultimate authority. There is no human governing authority that is the ultimate authority, because even if they don't recognize it, any government has its authority from God. And whilst we can read these words of St. Paul and say, well, there's no qualification here, he just tells us to submit, implicitly, because it acknowledges that a governing authority's authority derives from God, therefore there is an implicit qualification. The ultimate authority to whom we submit is God. But under God, we are to submit in general to a governing authority, a state, a federal, a local government, a regime, whether dictatorship or democracy, capitalist or communist, Islamic or not. Whatever it is, we are in general to submit to it under God's authority. That does not necessarily mean, of course, that in every single thing we must be obedient. There are a number of cases in the Bible of civil disobedience where the people of God are approved by God for disobeying and rebelling against the authority of their day. When the Israelites were in Egypt under their oppression in the book of Exodus, part of that oppression at one point was the command from Pharaoh to kill all the Israelite children. But the Israelites and their midwives disobeyed. And Exodus chapter 1 makes it clear that God approved of their disobedience because killing babies was wrong. Later in the Old Testament, three people by the name of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego refused to bow down to a statue of the emperor Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon and worship it. Again, they were approved. Their act was approved by God, as seen from the fact that he rescued them miraculously from fire to which they had been cast in punishment. A little later, again in the book of Daniel, Daniel himself refused to obey the prohibition that said you could not pray to any god other than the emperor Nebuchadnezzar. He refused, he was caught, he was thrown into a lion's den, but God's approval of his civil disobedience is seen in the fact that God rescued him from the lion's den. Later on, still in the Old Testament, Queen Esther disobeys the protocol and rules of the king and goes into his presence without permission. Her predecessor as queen had, in effect, similarly broken that law, although in reverse, and had been deposed. But God rewarded her civil disobedience by rescuing the Israelite people from the threat of genocide under Persian rule. And then, of course, in New Testament times, the apostles of Jesus Christ were commanded by the authorities not to preach the gospel. They refused. And God, the Acts of the Apostles makes clear, approved of their refusal to obey the state. So it seems that from the Bible story that there are a number of times when it is right to exercise civil disobedience or insubordination. But in each case, it is when there is a command from the state or the governing authority to commit sin, to kill babies, to commit idolatry, to pray to another god or so-called god, and not to preach the gospel, for example. So when a state, it seems that when a state or governing authority orders us in some way to commit sin, then they have broken the bounds of their authority under God. And Christians are right, indeed must, civilly disobey. Now this is a complex issue and there are many grey areas, but the basic starting point is, if a government commands us in effect to do what a Christian would regard as sin, we must disobey the government and rather obey God. Not to kill babies, not to commit idolatry, not to be prevented from preaching the gospel. So how does that view sit with Romans 13 that is so positive about government? Well, the government and the governing authorities have their authority from God. It is an ideal picture in some sense. But the general thrust of Romans 13 is to submit. It is not a passage about trying to find loopholes so that we don't have to submit. The thrust of Romans 13 is submit to the governing authorities. Indeed, there's a clear warning in verse 2 if we don't. If you resist authority, then you resist what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. And implicitly, that is not only judgment from the governing authority, but ultimately also from God. So the president of South Africa in 1985 had it wrong. It was not his right to force sinful behaviour onto Christians. It seems that perhaps he was overstepping his mark in one sense by reading those words to the Christian leader who came to him. But Paul's positive words also must be, we must take in the context in which he wrote. In the 50s AD, when he wrote this letter to the Roman Church, there were significant revolts in Rome over the issue of taxation. Roman historian Tacitus tells us about the revolts in the period of the mid to late 50s AD. Paul probably writes at the early point of that revolt, but no doubt there was a simmering unrest, and not dissimilar probably from the Britain of the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher's poll tax. Here we had in Rome great revolts and unrest by widespread citizenship of Rome against the high taxes that were being inflicted upon them. Taxes that were both direct tax as well as indirect tax, such as we have with a GST. Christians, it seems, some Christians at least, probably thought that with Jesus as their king, rightly so, then it gave them freedom to disobey and not to pay taxes and not to be involved as submitting citizens of the Roman Empire. And remember, of course, that just 6 or 7 years before this letter was written, Christians had been expelled, maybe wrongly, but for some riots with Jews in 49 AD under Claudius the emperor. In that context of unrest, Paul is saying the Christian obligation is to submit to the governing authority. Government is God's good gift for the ordering of society as well as for the dominion of this world. God does not approve of anarchy, therefore. There's no one right model of government, though. Democracy or dictatorship, capitalist or communist, monarchy, republic. There's not one right, God-given model of government. We tend to think that democracy is the greatest form of government, but it does have its flaws and its weaknesses. Regardless of the form, government is God's gift for the ordering of society, and its basic function, at least as described in these verses, is to punish wrongdoing and to approve of the doing of right. So verse 3, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Then do what's good, and you'll receive its approval. For it's God's servant for your good. But if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid. For the authority does not bear the sword in vain. It's the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. Now notice there too a tie-in to what we saw at the end of chapter 12 last week. There we were commanded not to repay evil for evil and to leave room for the wrath of God. So that it's not an individual's responsibility to go around wreaking revenge or punishing wrongdoers. We're to leave room for the wrath of God, which fundamentally has as its context awaiting the final judgment day when Jesus returns. But this passage of Romans 13 adds another dimension to that. Governments, even imperfect ones, have a function under God of executing his judgment and his wrath, even if it is imperfect. And notice too that Paul seems to endorse in verse 4 the right of government to carry out capital punishment. He says in verse 4, it is the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. The little bit before that. For the authority does not bear the sword in vain. He's not talking about military campaigns, but the word for sword there was the sword that was used for capital punishment. Paul seems to endorse the right of government for capital punishment. Now it may well be that we cringe from that and say, well, it's a little bit old-fashioned and a little bit barbaric. We've moved on to more sophisticated times, and capital punishment ought not to be part of the pattern of punishment of a government. Could it be a coincidence, or is it linked, that the decline in Christianity in the Western world in the last 100 or 200 years is coincidentally linked with the abhorrence and decline in capital punishment? That is, our societies in the West have become more and more humanist in their motivation. Basically, governments in the West are secular humanist governments. And the thing that is prized above anything else in humanist society is human life, to be preserved at any cost. Christians know that God's the judge, and that will mean not only physical death, but eternal death. That is, human life is important for Christians, but it is not the be-all and end-all. It has a place within eternity for us, so that death for Christians has lost its sting, and for those who are not Christians, it is the right execution of God's judgment and justice. So that Paul's endorsement here of capital punishment may be telling us that there is a place for government to execute capital punishment. It must be restrained, of course. It must be for serious offences. In the Old Testament, it was limited to very fundamental and severe sins. The same ought to be the case. It ought not to be barbaric or cruel. It ought not to be in form of torture, of course. And any shadow of doubt in a particular case ought to lead to some sort of lesser sentence. But nonetheless, it seems that the Christian faith and scriptures allow the possibility of capital punishment. Now in the Old Testament, the form of government was meant to be what we would call a theocracy, God as the king. He would rule by the laws that would be mediated through the priests of the nation. Now in time, of course, it didn't work like that. The society corrupted a bit. They had judges and other leaders and ultimately a king and a monarchy. Often that king and monarchy would drift very far from the laws of God. Indeed, we read in the Old Testament how it had completely forgotten them at one point until it rediscovered them in the temple by accident. Despite his Jewish background, Paul does not advocate a theocracy of government. That is, he doesn't in any way say here to these Christians, or seem to even imply, that their ideal is to grow the church to be so strong that the church becomes the government and becomes the state, so that the church is in control. That's not Paul's aim here. He writes to Christians under a pagan regime. He writes as one under a pagan regime. And not for one minute does he say that we ought to be striving for a Christian state government. The model of church controlling the state does not seem to be a Christian model. But the opposite is not either. The opposite is where the state controls the church. The technical word for that is Erastianism, named after a man called Erastus in the 16th century in Switzerland. Erastianism is where the state controls the religion. Now, in the Reformation period, it was the issue of whether the state, as a Christian state, could control the church in the Reformation time. But we see the same sort of thing in Islamic states, where the Islamic church is to control the government. We see it in communist states, where the communist and usually atheistic governments restrict and control the religious practices within their country. But we also see it, even today, to a small extent, in, say, Great Britain, where it is the government officially who appoints the bishops of the Church of England, and the government officially who must give approval to any liturgical changes for Sunday services in Britain. That seems to me not to be a model that is right, nor one that St. Paul is advocating here. The right sort of model is where there is a distinction of responsibilities between the state and the church. There may be tension, there may sometimes be opposition, there may sometimes be harmony. But each has its responsibilities. The church is not to, the state is not to inflict its own laws upon the restraint of religion and practice of faith. Nor is the church, in effect, to try to control society. Not to say, of course, that the state has no place to say something about religion, nor that the church, rightly indeed, has a place to say things about the way society should be ordered. Of course it does. And the two should interrelate at that point. What then does submission look like? What does it mean for us to submit to the governing authority? What it means is that, one, we accept the government that is duly elected to be our government. Thankfully, in our country, that usually happens. We can change governments without great unrest and coups and violence. It ought to be that if a government is rightly in office, then we are not to respond with unrest or violence or trying to topple it, and so on. It means adherence to the laws of the land. For example, yesterday, coming back from our staff 2 days away as a planning retreat for the year, driving back from Point Lonsdale, the comment was made that if we are to submit to the government, that I must restrict myself to the speed limit, even though I think the speed limits on the Geelong Road, even with roadworks, are pretty stupid. I wanted to cover up my speedo so that the other staff members in my car didn't dob me in. It means that we adhere to things like proper building regulations and customs and quarantine laws and all the other sorts of laws in our society. Whether or not we think they're the best laws, our job is to submit to them and live by them. It also means that we pay our taxes. And Paul seems to see that that's a significant issue to the Roman Church. And as I mentioned, there'd been unrest over the issue of taxation in the 50s AD. So he says in verse 6, "For the same reason you also pay taxes. For the authorities are God's servants busy with this very thing," that is, exercising government in society. "Pay to all what is due them. Taxes," that is direct taxes to those to whom taxes are due, "and revenue," that is indirect tax, to whom revenue is due. Now it's almost an Australian characteristic to be a cheater on your tax. I know ministers who cheat on their tax, who get paid from funeral companies for funerals or wedding couples for weddings and keep the money themselves, never declare it on their tax. It's more or less cash in hand, under the counter sort of stuff. Well, that doesn't happen here. All the money we get from weddings and funerals gets paid to Holy Trinity and not to the ministers. Rightly so, in my opinion. But there are plenty of people in our society who will quickly take cash in hand, issue no receipts, therefore, there's no need to declare that on our tax return, and so on. Christians are under obligation, as indeed all citizens of Australia are anyway, but Christians are under a religious and moral obligation as well to pay our taxes and to do so in full. There are right ways of and appropriate ways of minimising our tax, but certainly not cheating on our tax. Paying taxes is part of our sustaining the good order of society that God has given as a gift under his own authority. And even when our society and government, like ours is pagan and secular in nature, it is still there in part to fulfil the creation command to exercise dominion over this world, and we are to submit to it and therefore support it by the payment of our taxes. Even more than that, Paul finishes this section by saying not only do we pay taxes and revenue to whom it's due, but also respect, literally fear, to whom it is due, and honour, to whom honour is due. Both fear, or respect, and honour are words that are appropriate about how we relate to God in other parts of the Bible. What this is in effect saying is that because government is God's servant, we respond to God with fear and honour, so are we to respond to government with fear and honour. And that is respect and honour. And that will mean in part that we pray for our government, as we do in Sundays in church and ought to do during the week as well. Elsewhere in the New Testament, Paul commands Timothy to be praying for government so that Christians can live peaceably in the world and in society. Same sort of thing happened in the Old Testament. Jeremiah commanded the Israelites, when they were under the oppressive and evil regime of Babylon, to pray for the welfare of Babylon and pray for its government, though it was pagan and opposed to the people of God. Well, in sum, we have little reason not to submit to our government in this country. Even though at times it will do what we don't think it should do, times we may think it to be weak, even corrupt, there is no real reason for us, basically, not to submit to our government and its laws. In our society, we're fortunate in having plenty of opportunity to inform ourselves about government, to exercise our opinions by voting, by the media, by petitions or letters. As we do so, and if we protest, we must protest legally and peaceably. They are principles in these chapters of Romans that we should adopt. That is, not violently, and not with hatred. We ought to thank God for the freedom we have in this country to, by and large, practice our Christian faith without hindrance. It may be that that will change, and it may be right that when we see the foretaste of laws that might infringe our Christian faith and practice and rights, then we ought to protest them quite strongly. For example, in the racial and religious vilification laws that some states, including ours, have tried to adopt in recent times, there is, it seems to me, a threat at least that there may be infringements and restrictions placed on Christian behaviour, that is, at the level of trying to win other people for Christ. If that does indeed end up the case, then we must disobey that part of the law. It may be, I suspect, that in time it may even become illegal, for example, to speak against things like the practice of homosexuality. If that is the case, that is an infringement on Christian freedom and practice, and ought to be opposed. We ought also, though, because we are in such a lucky country, pray for those in other countries where it is illegal, in effect, to practice the Christian faith, where it's illegal to gather with Christians to worship, maybe other than at a state church, or at all, in places like Saudi Arabia and China. We must pray for those where they're prevented by law from preaching the gospel. That is an infringement and restriction on Christian behaviour that must be opposed. So we must pray for those who have to break the law of their country in order to do what Christ commands us to do. Pray that they do not repay evil for evil. Pray that they live peaceably with all. Pray for the reform of their government, and pray that they may, to the end, be faithful to Christ above all. Finally, these instructions in Romans 13 fit into the wider context of offering our whole lives to God as a sacrifice of worship. Chapter 12, as we remember from the end of last year and saw last week as well, is a turning point in the letter of Romans. In the light of the mercies of God as expressed in the gospel, expounded in chapters 1 to 11, we are to offer ourselves, holus bolus, so to speak, for God. All too often we compartmentalize our Christian lives, that our Christian faith is restricted to Sunday mornings, occasional Bible study groups, church activities, maybe a little bit of quiet prayer before we fall asleep at night or something like that, but the rest of the lives we just carry on as normal. But our response to God, we're seen, is to be all of our lives. So that not just in a sense the Christian activity of our life, but our life in society, our life in response to our government and submitting to our government, is therefore also to be part of our Christian response to the mercy of God. There's no part of our life that is outside the jurisdiction and ultimate authority of God. And therefore everything we do, in whatever context we live, is to be done submitting ultimately to God as the ultimate authority.